participation in retirement plans to rise by roughly 30 percentage points. Such was the power of choice architecture. One tweak to the society's choice architecture made by Sunstein, once he'd gone to work in the U.S. government, was to smooth the path between homeless children and free school meals. In the school year after he left the White House, about 40% more poor kids ate free school lunches than had done so before, back when they, or some adult acting on their behalf, had to take action and make choices to get them. Even in Canada, Don Redelmeyer still heard the sound of Amos in his head. He'd been back from Stanford for several years, but Amos's voice was so clear and overpowering that it made it hard for Redelmeyer to hear his own. Redelmeyer could not pinpoint the precise moment that he sensed that his work with Amos was not all Amos's doing, that it had some Redelmeyer in it, too. His sense of his own distinct value began with a simple question about homeless people. The homeless were a notorious drag on the local healthcare system. They turned up in emergency rooms more often than they needed to. They were a drain on resources. Every nurse in Toronto knew this. If you see a homeless person wander in, hustle them out the door as fast as you can. Redelmeyer wondered about the wisdom of that strategy, and so, in 1991, he created an experiment. He arranged for large numbers of college students who wanted to become doctors to be given hospital greens and a place to sleep near the emergency room. Their job was to serve as concierges to the homeless. When a homeless person entered the emergency room, they were to tend to his every need, fetch him juice and a sandwich, sit down and talk to him, help arrange for his medical care. The college students worked for free. They loved it. They got to pretend to be doctors, but they serviced only half of the homeless people who entered the hospital. The other half received the usual curt and dismissive service from the nursing staff. Redelmeyer then tracked the subsequent use of the Toronto healthcare system by all the homeless people who had visited his hospital. Unsurprisingly, the group that received the gold-plated concierge service tended to return slightly more often to the hospital where they had received it than the unlucky group. The surprise was that their use of the Greater Toronto healthcare system declined. When homeless people felt taken care of by a hospital, they didn't look for other hospitals that might take care of them. The homeless said, "That was the best that can be done for me." The entire Toronto healthcare system had been paying a price for its attitude to the homeless. A part of good science is to see what everyone else can see, but think what no one else has ever said. Amos had said that to him, and it had stuck in Redelmeyer's mind. By the mid-1990s, in startling ways, Redelmeyer was taking what everyone could see and thinking to say what no one had ever said. For instance, one day he had a phone call from an AIDS patient who was suffering side effects of medication. In the middle of the conversation, the patient cut him off and said, "I'm sorry, Dr. Redelmeyer, I have to go. I just had an accident." The guy had been talking to him on a cell phone while driving. Redelmeyer wondered, did talking on a cell phone while driving increase the risk of an accident? In 1993, he and Cornell statistician Robert Tibshirani created a complicated study to answer the question. The paper they wrote in 1997 proved that talking on a cell phone while driving was as dangerous as driving with a blood alcohol level at the legal limit. A driver talking on a cell phone was four times as likely as a driver who wasn't to be involved in a crash, whether or not he held the phone in his hands. That paper, the first to establish rigorously the connection between cell phones and car accidents, spurred calls for regulation around the world. It would take another, even more complicated study to determine just how many thousands of lives it saved. The study also piqued Redelmeyer's interest in what happened inside the mind of a person behind the wheel of a car. The doctors in the Sunnybrook Trauma Center assumed that their jobs began when the human beings mangled on nearby Highway 401 arrived in the emergency room. Redelmeyer thought it was insane for medicine not to attack the problem at its source. 1.2 million people on the planet died every year in car accidents, and multiples of that were maimed for life. 1.2 million deaths a year worldwide, said Redelmeyer. One Japanese tsunami every day. Pretty impressive for a cause of death that was unheard of 100 years ago. When exercised behind the wheel of a car, human judgment had irreparable consequences. That idea now fascinated Redelmeyer. The brain is limited. There are gaps in our attention. The mind contrives to make those gaps invisible to us, We think we know things we don't. We think we are safe when we are not. For Amos, it was one of the core lessons, said Redelmeyer. It's not that people think they are perfect. No, no, they can make mistakes. It's that they don't appreciate the extent to which they are fallible. I've had 3 or 4 drinks. I might be 5% off my game. No, you are actually 30% off your game. This is the mismatch that leads to 10,000 fatal accidents in the United States every year. It is sometimes easier to make the world a better place than to prove you have made the world a better place. Amos had said that, too. Amos gave everyone permission to accept human error, said Redelmeyer. That was how Amos made the world a better place, though it was impossible to prove. The spirit of Amos was now present in everything Redelmeyer did. It was present in his article about the dangers of driving while speaking on a cell phone, which Amos had read and commented upon. That was the article Redelmeyer was working on when the call came with the news that Amos had died. Amos told very few people that he was dying, and to those he did tell, he gave instructions not to spend a lot of time talking to him about it. He received the news in February 1996. From then on, he spoke of his life in the past tense. He called me when the doctor told him that it was the end of it, said Avishai Margalit. I came to see him, and he fetched me from the airport, and we were on our way to Palo Alto, and we stopped somewhere on the road with a view and talked about death and about life. It was important to him that he had his death under control, and the feeling was that he was talking not about himself, not about his death. There was a kind of stoic distance that was astonishing. He said, life is a book. The fact that it was a short book doesn't mean it wasn't a good book. It was a very good book. Amos seemed to understand that an early death was the price of being a Spartan. In May, Amos gave his final lecture at Stanford about the many statistical fallacies in professional basketball. His former graduate student and collaborator Craig Fox asked Amos if he would like for it to be videotaped. He thought about it and said, no, I don't think so, recalled Fox. With one exception, Amos didn't change his routine or even his interactions with those around him in any way. The exception was that, for the first time, he spoke of his experience of war. For instance, he told Varda Lieberman the story of how he had saved the life of the soldier who had fainted on top of the Bangalore mine. He said this one event, in a way, kind of shaped his entire life, said Lieberman. He said, once I did that, I felt obliged to keep this image of hero. I did that, now I have to live up to it. Most people with whom Amos interacted never even suspected he was ill. To a graduate student who asked if he would supervise his dissertation, Amos simply said, I'm going to be very busy the next few years, and sent him on his way. A few weeks before his death, he called his old friend Yeshu Kolodny in Israel. He was very impatient, which never happened, recalled Kolodny. He said, listen, Yeshu, I'm dying. I take it not tragically, but I don't want to talk to anyone. I need you to call our friends and tell them, not to call or visit. To his rule against visitors, Amos made an exception for Varda Lieberman, with whom he was finishing a textbook. He made another for Stanford President Gerhard Casper, but only because he'd gotten wind of Stanford's plan to commemorate him with a lecture series or conference in his name. Amos told Casper, you can do anything you want, recalled Lieberman, but I beg you, don't have a conference in my name with mediocre people who will talk about their work and how it is related to mine. Just put my name in a building or a room or a bench. You can put it on anything that is not moving. He accepted very few phone calls. One he took came from the economist Peter Diamond. I learned he was dying, said Diamond, and I learned he wasn't taking phone calls, but I had just finished my report to the Nobel Committee. Diamond wanted to let Amos know that he was on a very short list for the Nobel Prize in Economics, to be awarded in the fall, but the Nobel Prize was awarded only to the living. He didn't recall what Amos said to that, but Varda Lieberman was in the room when Amos took the call. I thank you very much for letting me know, she heard Amos say. I can assure you that the Nobel Prize is not on the list of things I'm going to miss. He spent the last week of his life at home, with his wife and children. He'd obtained the drugs he needed to end his own life when he felt it was no longer worth living, and found ways to let his children know what he planned to do without coming out and saying it. What do you think of euthanasia? He asked his son Tal casually. Toward the end, his mouth turned blue. His body was bloated. He never took painkillers. On May 29th, Israel held an election for prime minister, and a militaristic Benjamin Netanyahu defeated Shimon Peres. So I won't see peace in my lifetime, Amos said upon hearing the news, but I was never going to see peace in my lifetime. Late on the night of June 1st, his children heard from their father's bedroom the sound of footsteps and his voice, talking, perhaps, to himself, thinking. On the morning of June 2nd, 1996, Amos's son Oren entered his father's bedroom and found him dead. His funeral was a blur. It had an unreal feeling to it. The people in attendance could imagine many things, but they had trouble imagining Amos Tversky dead. Death is unrepresentative of Amos, said his friend Paul Slovic. Amos's Stanford colleagues, who had come to think of Danny as a figure from the distant past, were shocked when he appeared and approached the front of the synagogue. It was like seeing a fucking ghost, said one. He seemed disoriented, almost shell-shocked, recalled Avishai Margalit. There was a feeling of unfinished business. In a room filled with people dressed in dark suits, Danny had arrived in shirt sleeves, as he would have done for an Israeli funeral. That struck people as odd. He didn't seem to know where he was, but no one thought it was anything but correct that Danny delivered the main eulogy. It was clear that he was the one to talk, said Margalit. Their final conversations had been mostly about their work, but not all of them. There were things Amos wanted to say to Danny. He wanted to tell him that no one had caused him more pain in his life. To stop himself from echoing the sentiment, Danny had to bite his tongue. He also said that Danny was, even now, the person he most wanted to talk to. He said, I'm the one he's most comfortable talking to because I'm not afraid of death, recalled Danny. He knew I'm ready to die any time. As Amos approached his death, Danny spoke to him nearly every day. He wondered aloud at Amos's desire to keep on living exactly as he had, and his disinterest in fresh new experiences. What am I going to do, go to Bora Bora? Amos had replied. From that moment, Danny lost any interest he might have had in ever visiting Bora Bora. The mention of the name would forever trigger an uneasy ripple in his mind. After Amos had told him that he was dying, Danny had suggested that they write something together, an introduction to a collection of their old papers. Amos had died before they could finish. In their final conversation, Danny told Amos that he dreaded the thought of writing something under Amos's name of which Amos might disapprove. I said, I don't trust what I'm going to do, Danny said, and he said, you will just have to trust in the model of me that is in your mind. Danny remained at Princeton, where he had gone to escape Amos. After Amos's death, Danny's phone rang more often than ever. Amos might be gone, but their work lived on, and it was getting more and more attention. And when people spoke of it, they no longer said Tversky and Kahneman. People began to refer to Kahneman and Tversky. Then, in the fall of 2001, Danny received an invitation to visit Stockholm and speak at a conference. Members of the Nobel Committee would attend, along with leading economists. All the speakers but Danny were economists. Like Danny, they were all pretty obviously under consideration for the prize. It was an audition, said Danny. He worked hard to prepare his talk, which he knew had to be about something other than the work he had done with Amos. Some of his friends found that odd, as it was the joint work with Amos that had caught the interest of the Nobel Committee. I was invited for the joint work, said Danny, but I needed to show that I, on my own, am good enough. The question wasn't, was the work worthy? The question was, am I worthy? Danny didn't usually prepare his talks. He had once given a college commencement speech entirely off the cuff, and no one seemed to realize that he hadn't thought about what he was going to say until he sat on the dais waiting to be announced. That talk in Stockholm he'd really worked on. I sweated it out to such an extent that I spent a lot of time choosing the exact color of the background for the slides, he said. His subject was happiness. He spoke of the ideas that he most regretted not exploring together with Amos, how people's anticipation of happiness differed from the happiness they experienced, and how both differed from the happiness they remembered. How you could measure these things by, say, questioning people before, during, and after painful colonoscopies. If happiness was so malleable, it made a mockery of economic models that were premised on the idea that people maximized their utility. What exactly was to be maximized? After his talk, Danny returned to Princeton. He had the idea that if he was ever to be given a Nobel Prize, it would be the following year. They'd seen and heard him in the flesh. They'd judge him worthy or not. All potential winners were aware of the day the call from Stockholm would come, in the early morning, were it to come at all. On October 9, 2002, Danny and Anne sat in their home in Princeton, both waiting and not waiting. Danny was actually writing a reference for one of his star graduate students, Terry O'Dean. He honestly hadn't thought much about what he would do if he won a Nobel Prize, or rather he had specifically not allowed himself to think much about what he would do if he won a Nobel Prize. As a child during the war, he'd cultivated an active fantasy life. He would play out elaborate scenes with himself at the center of them. He imagined himself single-handedly winning the war and ending it, for example. But because he was Danny, he made a rule about his fantasy life. He never fantasized about something that might happen. He established this private rule for his imagination once he realized that, after he had fantasized about something that might actually happen, he lost his drive to make it happen. His fantasies were so vivid that it was as if you actually had it. And if you actually had it, why would you bother to work hard to get it? He'd never end the war that killed his father, so what did it matter if he created an elaborate scenario in which he won it single-handedly? Danny had not allowed himself to imagine what he would do if he were given a Nobel Prize, which was just as well, as the phone didn't ring. At some point, Anne got up and said, a bit sadly, "Oh, well." Every year there were disappointed people. Every year there were old people waiting by phones. Anne went off to exercise and left Danny alone. He'd always been good at preparing himself for not getting what he wanted, and in the grand scheme of things, this was not a hard blow. He was fine with who he was and what he had done. He could now safely imagine what he would have done had he won the Nobel Prize. He would have brought Amos's wife and children with him. He would have appended to his Nobel lecture his eulogy of Amos. He would have carried Amos to Stockholm with him. He would have done for Amos what Amos could never do for him. There were many things Danny would have done, but now he had things to do. He went back to writing his enthusiastic reference for Terry O'Dean. Then the phone rang.
The Undoing Project, A Friendship That Changed Our Minds, was written by Michael Lewis and read by Dennis Boutsakaris. It was recorded at Simon & Schuster Audio in New York by Noriko Okabe and Ernie Indradot. Editing and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producers were Tiffany Frari and Taryn Ocko. The Undoing Project, A Friendship That Changed Our Minds, was produced and directed by Christina Zarafanidis. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Also available from Simon & Schuster Audio, Michael Lewis's The Big Short, Inside the Doomsday Machine, read by Jesse Boggs, and Flash Boys, A Wall Street Revolt, read by Dylan Baker.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.